hagiography is? The two people that I thought would might know that aren't here. Hagiography. It's technically, the technical meaning for that, or the first meaning, is a writing about a saint. Writings about a saint. Hagio in Greek is saint or a holy person. So hagiography is writing, graphy, being writing, is writing about a saint. And it's a popular, it was a popular genre of writing from the, you know, in Christian times all along through the Middle Ages and even to current days. And you could say in some ways or another that it even preceded the era of saints, you know, the Christian era, when people would write very flattering things about others. The word has come to also take on a connotation of any biography that's just totally flattering and doesn't, and just whitewashes over all the negatives, as if somebody's almost perfect and they don't deal with the reality. It'd be like telling stories of George Washington, like we have. It's something we do in our own culture. You know, George Washington being this great leader and did all kinds of great things. He didn't want to become a king. He was our first president. He chopped down the cherry tree. He didn't tell a lie. That's probably made up. But that's the kind of things that were in hagiographies. You come up with good stories to make people look good, or in this case, you know, look better than they already are. They already look good, but we're going to make them look even better. So that type of writing is a type of writing that that whitewashes the negative things and puts the focus on the positive things, and perhaps even invents a few positive things to make it sound even better. And so any biography these days that goes over the top with all these positive things is known as a hagiography. It's one of the words. Now, why would I bring that up? Because to me, it's a significant part of the evidence for the authenticity of the Bible, that the Bible, by and large, is not a hagiography. If you ever notice, when you read through the Bible, there's this person who's a hero and he's got a problem. And there's this person who's a hero and she's got this issue and that issue. It brings up the bad stuff. Now, I can remember, maybe you can remember this. I don't have this in my notes, but I wanted to say it came back to me. I don't know if you remember, but some of us were part of an organization in years past that had this chart of how it was governed. And it was a chart that looked very much like a triangle. And it had God at the top, and then it had Jesus, and then it had Mr. this person, and Mr. that person, and Mr. a bunch of other people. And it just came down and got wider like that. And we actually heard, I heard with my own ears, I'm sure many of you did, the thought that we're going to take this, God's going to take this structure that we had come up with, for the most part, and he's going to take it right on into the world tomorrow, and the world tomorrow's, you know, we're all ready to rule. We're ready to go. We got the chart already, and we got the system, and we're going to go and march right into the world tomorrow, and we're going to take care of things. And even as a young person, I thought, boy, you know, pity the poor world if that's the way it's going to work. If the world's run anything like the church I was in at the time, I was worried for the world. But that was our idea. That was our idea. And part of that thinking, I can remember hearing people say from the pulpit that, you know, the book of Acts doesn't really have a conclusion to it. It doesn't have an end. You know, Luke didn't write, you know, say hi to Mary and Joe and Bob, you know, and whatever. There's just no conclusion. It just kind of stops. And people speculated out loud that that meant, perhaps, that God would add to the book of Acts and that the things that we were doing would be in there. Now, I didn't think about it at the time, but since then I've thought about that a little bit. And when I read through the Bible, and we're going to talk about this a lot today, you read through the Bible and see the kinds of stories that are in the Bible about some of the heroes, like David, who we're just reading about. And you think, well, you know, if my story's in the book of Acts, chances are it won't look too good on me. I don't want my story in there. Maybe you want yours in, maybe you don't. But I'd be more than happy not to be included in the update on the book of Acts, if there is such a thing. And you know, I don't want my sins to be immortalized in a book that's going to last forever. And yet, the people that are written up in the Bible, that's a lot of what you see in there. So anyway, that to me, the fact that the heroes of the Bible have their faults exposed in the writings gives me some confidence that these writings are authentic. Now, by that, I don't mean that every single thing, every little word you read is exactly right. I don't mean that, but I'm just talking about this authentic. These people were not trying to paint a rosy picture of their heroes, usually. Now, there are exceptions to that. You know, we're reading, in Bible reading, we're reading Samuel and Kings, right? Samuel and Kings has a lot of negative stuff about the kings, especially about David. If you read Chronicles, you read 1 Chronicles, that negative stuff isn't there. So whoever was writing Chronicles later, it was written later, whoever was writing Chronicles, it wasn't part of their purpose to bring out the bad stuff about David. But it's not hidden because it's over in Kings. And you know, several times in Chronicles it says, you want to know more about this king, you want to know more about that king, go over to the Book of the Kings or the Book of something else. So we have it, we have both sides of the story there. And you could perhaps say, well, Chronicles, too big of a whitewash brush there. Well, maybe it is, but the truth is in other books. That's not what I want to talk about. But what I do want to talk about is that the Bible, to me, is a very unique book because it's a collection of stories of wisdom, of history, of poetry, of biography, and letters. You know, in the New Testament, there's a lot of letters. And these examples of I don't know what you want to call it. They're literature. They're different kinds of literature. You know, a poem is a different thing than a history, and a wisdom literature like Proverbs is a different thing from a letter that Paul writes. So there's lots of different genres mixed together in this book, and you don't read them all the same way. But my point is that all of those genres, all of those things that are included in the book, are products of the real world. And the authors, for the most part, didn't go to any great expense or time or effort to try to hide the truth that's out there from the real world. Some of that truth was kind of unpleasant, but it's in there. And to me, that makes the book more authentic than it would be otherwise. I'm not saying you have to think the same way, but that's how I feel. That's one of the things that's always given me confidence about the Bible, that it includes the dirt on the heroes. And, you know, that has its reasons why it does. But I think we can learn from that. You see, the book is written as all these stories, all these things from different people and different walks of life, but they're all in the real world. And you and I happen to live in the real world, too. And you may have noticed that you live in a real world. And perhaps it might be helpful to look at some of these people in the real world that they lived in and some of their real world problems and even the heroes and see how they functioned in this and how God functioned in this. And once we're informed of this in this way and in this perspective, I think we might be a little bit encouraged to think about what God, is still doing today with us in the real world. So the Bible isn't, from out there in outer space. It's from the real earth, the real world, where we live. So if you want a title, this is the title of the sermon. God and People, God and People, a Partnership. God and People, a Partnership. That's what I chose to call it. And I've got basically 6 points, one of which is broken down into some other ones. I'm going to annoy people like me, although I won't annoy me because I'm up here, but if I were sitting out there, I would be annoyed because I'm not going to give you the points first. I'm going to talk about it first and got to figure out what the point is. So just leave yourself a blank. When I say here's point number one, writer one, and leave a blank line because I'm not going to give you the point. We're going to talk about it first and then come back and realize what the point is. I actually don't like that when I'm sitting there. Maybe you don't like it either. I don't know, but we'll see. That just seemed to work better. So we'll start with the first point, which I'm not going to tell you what it is. And the first point, where's a good place to start anything with number one? In the beginning. That's where we're going to start. Genesis 1:1. Because, say what you want about Genesis, it's got the beginnings. It's got the first, the way things were at the beginning. And it sets the stage for the rest of the book. So it's good to understand the beginning. Genesis 1, verse 1, and you know this, I'm not going to read anything we don't already know. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth became or was without form and void, however you want to read it. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. I have the King James here today. God said, let there be light, and there was light. Now, that's pretty simple, isn't it? You could complicate it, but it's just there, let there be light. And there was light. It's eight, right? Eight words. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. He said something, and it was done. Now, we don't know how it was done. We don't know, you know, the details. It doesn't. It's not trying to give details. It's not the point of the account. And my excuse me, the point of the sermon isn't to get into those kinds of details. I don't care what those details are for the purpose of the sermon. My point about bringing that verse out is that it's just very simply put, God said it, and it was done. This whole writing, the first chapter, is very stylized, very simplified. But that's, you know, that's all that was necessary for the writer to put in there. The point I want to make is that when it comes to creation, God gets his way. God gets what he wants. He says, let there be light, and there's light. Not let there be light, and we have a negotiation with a bunch of people to see whether we can have it or not, and we got to pay some overtime because it's not in the contract. And you know, it's not complicated. Didn't have to bring in the night shift with Ray on it. You know, it just, God said it and it happened. When it comes to doing things with the material world, or before there was a material world, God just said it and did it, and it happened. Very simple. Now, if we go to a few verses later, like verse 26, God decides he wants to make some people. And he says, let us make man in our image. We know that. And to have dominion over the earth, it says. And God created man in his image, in verse 27. He made them male and female, and he blessed them and told them to be fruitful and multiply and so forth. Gave them some instructions. I've given you, verse 29 says, I've given you every green herb bearing seed which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree which is upon which is the fruit of the tree yielding seed, and to you it shall be for meat, and to every beast, and so forth. So there's all these instructions. God made a person. That didn't seem to be very complicated, but once he made a person, started having to be a little, it got a little more complicated. We got some rules and instructions and some information to follow. But he saw everything and made that he made, and it was good. So at least it's not too awful complicated yet. But then we get to chapter 2. And if I'm going to skip down to verse 15, now he put him in Eden, put him in the special garden, you know, a place that was very blessed, to dress it and keep it, and told him that he could eat of every tree in the garden except for one, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, don't eat that. And then he made, you know, there was a woman, so we have male and female. I'd already said that before in chapter 1. And it talks about some other things. The beasts had been made and so forth. And Adam gave name to all the camels and all the animals, I'm sorry. And we have the woman. The woman is now bone of my bones and so forth. So we have a lot of detail here. But we also have some rules again. We have this tree that you can't eat of and other trees that you can eat of. And then we get to chapter 3. And you could read the whole chapter, but you're familiar with the chapter. And here we got the serpent that appears on the scene. The serpent says, yeah, God said you can't eat that tree, but really you can. It makes you smarter, you know more, you'll be more like God. And then it turns out that the woman saw, verse 6, that the tree was good for food. It was pleasant to the eyes and to be desired. And he ate, or she ate and gave it to his husband, and he ate. And their eyes were open and so forth. And you could go, we could read the whole rest of the chapter. We don't need to, but there were all kinds of consequences. Oh, we're going to blame, you know, Adam's going to blame Eve, and Eve's going to blame the serpent. The serpent says, you've never been fair anyway. And, you know, this is all of a sudden, life is complicated. I won't say all of a sudden necessarily, but we go from something that's very simple to now something that is not as simple as it was. All of us, we have complications. We have results, consequences later in chapter 3, which I don't have to go through. Consequences in birth, consequences in relationships. And here we haven't gotten very far into history yet. We already got all these issues. And the difference, it seems to me, from this perspective of this sermon, the difference is between God saying, all right, we want to, if I had a switch here, I could, you know, let there be light, turn on, off. It's presented as being that simple. He just turned it on it came. And it's presented as being that simple when he divided the waters from the firmament, right? And when he, those other things that he did. comes out very simple. And then we have people, and all of a sudden the world isn't simple anymore. Did you notice that? It gets complicated. Anybody got a suggestion what point one, what am I going to say point one is? When it comes to humans, what? When it comes to humans, let there be light doesn't necessarily work. When it comes to humans, let there be light doesn't usually work. God said, let there be no eating of this tree. Did that work? No. God said a lot of other things to humans. Did that work? Not so easily, did it? We could go through the whole Bible. The whole Bible is the history of all kinds of different people that didn't do what God said to one degree or another. Now, we shouldn't be terribly discouraged by this because it's all by God's design. You could write down Deuteronomy 8 and verse 2 if you'd like. It talks about that God led Israel through the wilderness and tested them. You know, they had the manna, they had different things, the rules that they had to follow to have the manna. And he tested them to see whether or not they would keep his law. It's part of the plan. When it comes to people, God doesn't just let there be light, and there's got to be light, but it works differently. It's a little more complicated. So that's the first point. When it comes to humans, let there be light doesn't usually work. Has anybody ever noticed that? Anybody ever have children? Don't raise your hands. Or grandchildren? Let there be light. Could be as simple as turn out the light. Or don't turn on the light or whatever. You know, it doesn't work that simple. It doesn't work that simply, does it, with human beings? We're a different breed. And God has, for his own reasons, decided that that's the way he wants it. He could have created robots or yellow pencils, as we might say. But he chose not to. He chose not to create us that way. He chose to create us with minds that have to make a choice. Of course, he tells us what to choose. Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 15 or verse 19. I'll read verse 19. Kind of say the same thing. Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 19. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life that both you and your seed may live. So the command's there to choose life, but it's required that we choose. Human beings have to choose. Light didn't have a choice whether it was going to come on or not in Genesis chapter 1. God said, let there be light. There was light. There wasn't a discussion. There wasn't a request for volunteers. But when it came to human beings, it's kind of a request for volunteers, isn't it? You choose life, please. It's a good choice, won't you? Won't you choose life? Do you volunteer to choose life? It's different, isn't it? It's the way God has chosen to work. He doesn't just let there be this or let there be that when it comes to human beings. He makes us make a choice. So that's point number one. When it comes to humans, let there be light doesn't usually work. Now I got point two. Excuse me. And we'll skip down to Genesis chapter 12. We're going to do a little bit of a survey of sorts of different people that God worked with and used to see what we can discover from that. Because they lived in the real world and they had real world problems, and you live in the real world and you have real world problems, so there might be a connection there. And I claim there is, and we're going to learn a little bit about that today. Genesis chapter 12. Again, there's nothing here that you don't know already. It's when God called Abram, right? Abram's up in, well, first of all, he's over in Mesopotamia, then God calls him, he goes up to Haran, is it? And then comes down to Palestine. We call him out of his father's house to a land he will show you. I will make of you a great nation. So God's already making promises here. Verse 2, Genesis 12. I will bless you and make your name great. You will be a blessing to others. I will bless them that, bless you. Curse him who curses you. And you will all families of the earth be blessed. So Abram departed. And a whole bunch of them departed. 75 people in total. So God had a job for Abram. So he figured he's going to pick a good guy, right? He's not going to mess up. But that's, you know, in general, that's true. Abram was a good guy. Abram listened. And if we read down the, you know, go down the story. Actually, we can go just to verse 10. We don't have to go very far. Verse 10, Abram had journeyed, and there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to stay there for a while, because the famine was grievous in the land up further north and east. And it came to pass that when he was close to entering into Egypt, he said unto his wife, he said, now I know that you're a good looker, right? You look pretty nice. When we come down here to Egypt, they're going to want to put you in the harem. So just say you're my sister. Because if you say you're my husband, they'll kill me just to get you. So Abram is a bit of a liar here. Takes things into his own hands. And you know the story. We could also go to chapter 20, verses 1 and 2. And he did the same thing again. So Abram, in spite of being the one chosen by God to do a job, he's got his issues. He lived in the real world, and he had real world problems, and he didn't always handle things the best way. You can go to Genesis chapter 25 and read about his son Isaac. And we could read a lot of verses, but let's just read 27 and 28. It talks about Isaac's children. Isaac had twin children. Isaac and Rebekah had children named Jacob and Esau, right? And it says the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of the venison, and Rebekah loved Jacob. So here we got the makings of a dysfunctional family. We got the father favoring one, the mother favoring another, and it led to all kinds of problems in history according to the book of Genesis and the books that follow. And the people that descended from Jacob and Esau had problems forever. 26, verse 6. And again, I won't read all of this, but you know the story. Of course, there are promises to be kept, but Isaac dwelt in Gerar, it says, and the men of the place asked him about his wife. It's the same thing. We got this deal going on of his wife. He says, she's my sister. So Isaac is the same problem as his father. You know, the apple didn't fall very far from the tree, I guess is the expression. So here's Isaac, just like his father. And we can move on to chapter 27. And in 27, we have the story of Jacob stealing Esau's blessing and how he went about it, deceived his father with his mother's involvement and encouragement. And he's got all the makings of just a mess in history. And these are the people these are the individuals from whom the nation of Israel descended. And you think they'd have a more sanitized version of their history, but they don't. They include all this stuff. They include all these little details which aren't all that flattering about their ancestors. But Jacob was a finagler and a bit of a liar. And it goes on to talk about Jacob's life in the book of Genesis as well. And, you know, he's already has a history with his father. Then he goes and lives with his mother's people, right? And it talks about how he was able to his uncle was very much, he was like his uncle. He was a chip off the old block. He was like his uncle. He was a finagler. He was able to make a dime when there wasn't a dime to be made. And here you had these two cheats working against each other, and it's this great story there in several of the chapters of Genesis. Who gets the most sheep, and who's got the most goats, and how it all works. And it had, you know, Jacob outwits his uncle is what it amounts to. And he ends up with more. And then his uncle changes the rules, and Jacob still outwits him. And that's just the way it works. Jacob looks to take advantage of people. And so he was very prosperous, but we don't know how honest he was about getting that way. And then, you know, he's got all these children. He's got all these different, he's got wives and his wives' servants and all these people. He's got the makings of a messed up family. He considers Joseph his oldest son, and it's one of his youngest children. You know, because he doesn't care for the others. He doesn't care for their mothers. And, you know, what a mess. But this is the history we're given. And these are the ancestors of the people of Israel that God was going to use. So what's this tell us? Well, now I'll give you point two. is that when God wants to get something done, he assigns it to an imperfect person. He assigns the task to an imperfect person. When God wants to get something done, he assigns the task to somebody who is not perfect, somebody who's got problems. It's either that or he has to do it himself, right? Because there aren't any perfect people. So he's decided to use people because that's what he's doing. He's in the business of working with people. And he has to pick imperfect people. And the Bible, you know, bless its heart, as you know, my grandmother would say, or my wife's grandmother would say, you know, it tells all the bad stuff, too, of these people. That's why I'm not so sure I'd want to be written up. Because it's kind of like getting written up in school. They don't write up the good stuff a lot of times. You get in the Bible, you might have a lot of bad stuff written up. Once in a while, God may send an angel. He needs to send an angel to do a job. But most of the time in the Bible, you see responsibilities being delegated to human beings. Human beings who got to have their problems because they live in the real world. So they're imperfect agents. The angels would be perfect agents, but the people are not. And we'll discuss this some more later on. But the fact is, at least historically, when you look in the book, from the beginning to the end, when God wants to get something done, he assigns the task to an imperfect person. That's the way he works. And it's all for a reason. We'll get into that at the end of the sermon. All for a reason. So, just saying, let there be light, that doesn't work too well with humans. And then to complicate matters even further, when God has something to do, he has to delegate it to a human, or he chooses to, he doesn't have to, but he chooses to delegate it to humans because that's what he does. That's the business he's in. Now I'm ready for the third point. Because you might think, well, we're just picking on, you know, picking on Adam, or we're picking on Abraham and Isaac or Jacob or whatever. But, you know, how about Moses? Moses is kind of a hero, right? Moses is one of the big ones in the Bible. In Deuteronomy chapter 34, Moses, you know, talked to God face to face. You know, God didn't give him a dream. He says, you know, when I want to talk to Moses, I just talk to him. I don't give him a vision. But in Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 10, it says, there arose not a prophet since in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. Well, no need to read the rest. You know, he's it. He's the epitome. There hadn't been one since before or since like Moses. So certainly Moses gets a, you know, good rap, doesn't he? Well, overall he does. But Numbers chapter 12. And this is a big one. Seemed to happen twice. Numbers 12. Now, this isn't what happened. I'm sorry. I want to read this first. Numbers 12 and verse 3 says, the man Moses was very meek above all men who were upon the face of the earth. Okay. So Moses was, he's top notch. You know, he come upper crust. Not only that, he was raised to be a king. He was a prince in Egypt, all that kind of stuff. So he was, you know, certainly he's not the same. He's not average. And he wasn't average. But you can write this down. I won't turn there and read it. Exodus chapter 4, verses 24 to 26. Talks about a time, and I don't really claim to understand this, but it's like God wanted to kill him because he hadn't circumcised his children. So there's a problem, and it's recorded in there for us. Even if we don't understand it, I'm saying I don't understand it. But it's a negative thing. It's not put in there as a positive thing. And then in Numbers chapter 20, and we read this a couple of times, in Numbers chapter 20, there was this rock that he was supposed to speak to, right, to get water. And he says, how long do we have to, you know, we're going to have to fetch water from this rock for you people? He gets frustrated. He gets upset with the people all the time. They're all the time testing his patience. And this time he took the staff and he hit the rock. Interesting thing, and I don't have this in my notes, I'll mention it now. Because even though Moses made that mistake, even though Abram made the mistakes of lying about his wife, and Isaac made the mistake, God, you remember, how did God react to those things, apparently, at least from what you read? You know, Pharaoh has a plague in his house. Excuse me. God backed up, not, he didn't back up the sin. of the people he was using, but he backed up, he had their back, put it that way. It's not that they didn't suffer for their sins, because they did. But God was still with them. And I didn't point that out. I should have pointed that out. God was with them. And Moses, God was with Moses, even though he made the mistake with the rock, even though he made the mistake about not circumcising his sons, even though he made other mistakes, God still backed him up. Not in his mistakes, not in his sins, but God backed him up in what he had Moses doing. And he didn't let other people, you know, say, well, you know, in a sense, disqualify Moses. Go on, Moses had this. Moses married this woman. Moses this, Moses that. God didn't, he didn't have any of it. He knew what Moses' problems were, but God was using Moses anyway. Now, I'm not saying we have a Moses today. I'm not using this as a to teach us anything in particular about any individuals today. That's not my point. But my point is that even in spite of their mistakes, in spite of their shortcomings, God used them. And in the sense that God used them, God backed them up in what he was doing with them. And Moses didn't enter the promised land. Right? He was in the same boat as all the people except for Joshua and Caleb that had to die by the side of the road. So here's Moses, a hero, a definite hero in the Bible. And a lot, and there's some negative press there, negative ink. David, I don't need to read it. We're reading it in Samuel and Kings. David, you know, he worked for the enemy. He stayed in Philistia for a while, and he worked for the Philistine kings. He was an adulterer, and then he murdered the woman's husband. He had his own issues in his own family. He had a son that tried to take the king, the crown from him. He was reduced one time to fleeing Jerusalem because of that son. You could go on and on about David. Bloody man, not allowed to build a temple because he was a bloody man. It's got negatives. It's got negatives in there. And he's, along with Moses, he's one of the Old Testament heroes. Maybe they're the two top heroes, Moses and David. And they have their issues, don't they? Now you could say the hero, the obvious hero in the New Testament is Jesus. And Jesus is perfect. So we can't have anything negative about Jesus, can we? Well, in a way, yes, we can. And by that, I mean Jesus was perfect, but Jesus was a human being. And the Bible doesn't make any bones about it. You can write these scriptures down. You know, in Philippians 2, verse 8, we know it just talks about that Jesus became, let me read it. I don't want to misquote it. You know, he stopped being what he was and became human. And that had definite implications. He was a sinless human. But he was a human nonetheless. Philippians 2. Could read, you know, the whole beginning of the book there, but, or that chapter, but I'll just read verse 8. Being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Jesus subjected himself to the limitations of being a human being. Matthew 26. Guess I'll turn there first. Now, what do I mean by this? I just mean that even a hero like Jesus was human. Not a sinful human, but he was human. Matthew 26, beginning in verse 37. Long chapter there. Then came Jesus with them into a place called Gethsemane. Of course, this is on the night he was arrested. And he said with the disciple, you know, sit here while I go pray yonder. That's where we got yonder. Go play. He took with him, excuse me, Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, James and John. And he began to be sorrowful and very heavy. All right, this is our hero, Jesus. But because he was human, he was sorrowful. He was very heavy. There are other expressions. You can get other translations. But you know, I don't know what all that means exactly, but maybe afraid a little bit. He prayed several times that God would take this away from him. He wasn't looking forward to it. Of course, you wouldn't look forward to it either. He was human. He was dreading what was coming, and he was looking for a way out because he was human. That's normal for humans to look for a way out of suffering. And our Savior looked for a way out of suffering. But if it meant that you and I wouldn't be saved, no, he closed his mind to that. And that's what it meant, apparently. And that's, you know, he had to go through with it. But he didn't want to. Part of him did, and part of him didn't. His physical part didn't want to suffer. He was real, human, living in a real world. Luke 22, same account. And I'll read verse 44. It says, "And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was like great drops of blood." Now, he wasn't just, it wasn't just a theoretical thing in his head. "Oh, I don't know if I, you know, really want to do this or not." Now, it's something he felt in his gut. He felt very much that he didn't want to do it as a physical human being. Just like you would feel, just like I would feel. He was real. He was real. Mark 14, you could write down Mark 14 and verse 33. It says he was amazed and troubled, talking about the same time there. He was hungry. He'd be hungry. You know, after he fasted, he was very hungry. excuse me. In John chapter 4 and verse 6, it says he was tired, he was weary. He was human. He'd go through all the kinds of things that we went through. So even though he is certainly the Bible's greatest hero, and even though he did his job without sinning, I'm not pointing to any sin here, but he had human shortcomings, if you want to put it that way, because he was human. And those are written up. They're not hidden. They're not hidden from view here. They're in the Bible. So what's point number three? I'm talking about Abraham. Or I talked about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but now we're moving on to Moses and David and even Jesus. And point three, I would say even the Bible's greatest heroes have feet of clay. Even Jesus, in a sense, had feet of clay. And by that, I just mean he was human. He wasn't a sinner, but he was human. And the Bible doesn't hide these things. And the Bible doesn't hide the things about David or Moses, arguably the two greatest heroes in the Old Testament. Even the Bible's greatest heroes have feet of clay. So where am I going with this? We've got, you know, that let there be light doesn't work with human beings. When God wants to get something done, he's chosen to delegate those jobs to imperfect humans. And among these imperfect humans that we find in the Bible, and even the perfect one, which is Jesus, they all have their feet of clay. They all have shortcomings. They all have things that hold them down a little bit. In Jesus' case, what held him down was being a human. Okay? And a perfect human, but he's still human. So please get that. I'm not comparing Jesus to Moses saying he sinned. I don't mean that. But they have feet of clay. You know, they had their things that they couldn't do because they're human, or because in Moses' case or David's case, because they were also sinners. Not only that, but as I move on to point four here, and I don't want to spend a whole long time on this, but we could. The book of Judges. You've already read through the book of Judges in the scripture reading here recently. And when I read the book of Judges, it just blows my mind because there's just so much going on in Israel. It was terrible, most of it. There's hardly any good news. Jephthah, he ends up, it says, sacrificing his daughter in some way or another. We can dispute about it, you know, what that meant. Samson, he was a disaster. How did he end up in the end? I don't know. I'm not his judge, but what a messy life. Micah with his idols, the Levite with his concubine, and what happened with that. I don't want to get into that. There's all kinds of negative things I could look at. There was a civil war. The rest of Israel had a war with Benjamin and then felt bad about it. And, you know, what are we going to do? They don't have any men now. We got to give some men. They got all these women and the husbands. Yeah. It's just one thing after the other, the book of Judges. And David, we've already talked about. David's got his things. All kinds of things. David has his thing. It says, you know, Nathan said, I think it was Nathan, or at least it says in there in the Second Samuel, that David gave occasion to the enemies of Israel to blaspheme. That's pretty serious. In the New Testament, and I won't go into, I don't need to go there. You know, we got 1 Corinthians 5, we have incest in the church, we have in chapter 6, we've got different members taking each other to court. In chapter 7, we have marriage issues. In chapter 8 and chapter 10, we've got issues with idols and meat. In chapter 12 and chapter 14, we have the misuse of gifts that we have. God has given gifts and then they misuse them. It just goes on and on. And you get into the book of 3 John, just the one chapter there, you've got a guy that runs the local church that won't let the visitors from John. John would send a visitor, send an emissary, a representative, you know. It'd be like getting a representative from some other bigger church area, right? That would come here and want to speak. And we'd say, no, you can't come here. Or, you know, if you do show up in town, we're not going to let you stay at our house. And whoever was in charge of the congregation, this guy named Demetrius, he wouldn't let he wouldn't let the person that visited from John stay with him. And he would, if anybody in the church let him stay with them, he'd put him out of the church. So there you got Old Testament and Judges, just for example, Judges or David or any number of occasions. Then you get in the New Testament and the church. And what you end up with a lot of times is a mess. Now, I don't have an answer for that, but that's my point number four. And, you know, in this process of what God's doing, sometimes it gets messy. Sometimes in the real world, even when God is involved, it gets messy. The Corinthian church was a mess. Israel was a mess during the time of the judges. Israel was a mess during much of the time of David. It's just the way it was. Sometimes it just gets messy. It was messy at the end of the New Testament era. By that I mean around the end of the first century. It was a mess. It's been a mess more than once in my lifetime. I'm sure it has been in your lifetime. Why is it a mess? Well, I guess because God works with people. And people are imperfect. And that's just the nature of things. So now we're up to point five. I only have six. Point five. Luke chapter 9. I'm in Luke still. Luke chapter 9. Now this is, Jesus in the travel narrative, in Luke's travel narrative, if I remember correctly. And Jesus had decided he was going to go to Jerusalem. I want to go to verse 51. Yeah, he's going to go to Jerusalem. And he needed to have some place to stay on the way because it's more than a day's journey. So he was going to go through Samaria. And they didn't want him to stay with them, whoever it was in the Samaritan town. They didn't want him to stay there because if they would have wanted him to come and stay for a while, talk, preach to them, he wasn't going to do that. He was going to go to Jerusalem. He just needed a place to stay the night. They weren't receptive to that. And verse 54, when his disciples James and John saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven like Elijah did? Now, there's some zealous help. You know, you like to have help that really looks out for you that way, right? And these people don't want you to stay there? Well, let's zap them. Zeal. Of course, Jesus told them they didn't know what spirit they were of. And I just heard, I'll share this with you. I just heard this the other, week ago, 2 weeks ago, whatever it was. I was talking to a friend who mentioned, and we have talked about discipling, right? We've talked about that before, how Jesus was kind of like a rabbi and he had his disciples, and that was a normal relationship in first century Judea, that you had rabbis that would teach younger people and bring them along in the teachings of Judaism. Well, Jesus was doing the same thing, although he wasn't bringing them up to be rabbis and bring in the teachings of Judaism, but he was teaching them a new thing. What I never thought of before, I'm assuming that they're all young. Jesus is around 30, 33, somewhere in there. And while he's teaching, I'm assuming these other guys are his age. You know what? They're probably younger because that was typical. The rabbi had a few years on the people he was teaching. So I'm just throwing it out there. I never heard it before. Jerry mentioned to me, he said, they're probably younger. And I thought, yeah, they probably were. I don't know how young. I don't think they were teenagers, but they were somewhat younger. Good chance that they were. And maybe that helps make an excuse for James and John saying, why don't we just zap them? They don't want you to come down, just got that youthful drive and enthusiasm. Anybody ever had, don't raise your hand, any youthful drive and enthusiasm? I had plenty of it. You've probably seen enough of it, even while I'm a little bit older. But sometimes, my zeal embarrasses me now. I think about some of the things I was zealous about before I had any smarts. So that's the same way with James and John. And that's another reason why you don't want to be written up in the book, because they're going to, they're going to include the stuff before you got smart, too. That's just the way it worked. Luke 22, and we'll turn there, but you know the story. Judas betrays Jesus, shows the authorities where he is going to be that night. He comes out, says hi, gives him a kiss, they're ready to arrest him. And what does Peter do? Peter takes a sword, and it says he cuts off the high priest's servant's ear. Now, does anybody think that Peter was such an accomplished swordsman that he could cut off an ear if that's what he wanted to do? They didn't even have swords. They had to put some money together and buy some before they went out. Or something, they were talking about it anyway. These weren't swordsmen. He was not aiming for the ear. Okay? And Jesus healed him, it's all right. But here, there's some zeal there. Peter had all kinds of zeal. We know that. And you could write down the scriptures. We don't need to turn there. Matthew 26, verses 30 to 35, really all the way up to 75. Now, what does it talk about? It talks about Peter saying, I'm ready to go to prison with you, Jesus. Jesus said there's a prophecy from, was it Zechariah, that was going to be fulfilled, that the shepherd would be killed. I don't know if the word killed is used, but the shepherd would be gone and the sheep would be scattered. And he said, because of that, in fulfillment of that prophecy, you all are going to leave me when I get in my trouble here. And they asked, no. And Peter's the one that gets quoted. He says, I'm ready to go to jail, even die, if that's what it takes. And it says, only in one place, I don't remember, it's probably Matthew, it says, and all the other disciples said the same. So we can't just pick on Peter. They were all saying the same thing. We're with you. We're with you, man. I got your back. Don't worry about it. And what happened? They all ran. They all ran. Except for Peter. He didn't quite run. He kind of hung around, right? And it says when they got to one of the interrogations, he was kind of hanging out nearby. And that's when he got to deny Jesus three times, because three different people recognized him. Didn't maybe know who he was, but he talked funny because he was from Galilee and they figured it out. Oh, you're one of his guys, right? No, not me. Three times. But he wasn't the only one. They all said they would go to jail. They would do whatever. They're with him. Paul's another example of zeal. These guys had zeal, right? Excuse me, the disciples had zeal. Paul, it says, and when Stephen was stoned, it says that there was somebody giving approval, taking the jackets or whatever, he was like giving his approval. And it says his name was Saul. Stephen was martyred, Saul was there. Now, we can read in chapter 21, I guess, Acts chapter 21. What do I want to read in 21? I think I just want to read the last verse. Yeah, Paul, remember I've talked about this before. When Paul got arrested, I think it was because it might have been the time that they accused him of having a Gentile in the temple grounds. Now, the Romans didn't care about that. They weren't going to arrest him for that. But he was about ready to get stoned to death. And this Roman officer got him and started taking him up the steps, probably to that fort I've showed you that's right on the side of the temple, the fort that was there. So on his way up the steps, Paul says, can I talk to him? And so the officer gave him a chance. And then in chapter 22, he says, and I'll skip way down, well, off verse 1. He says, can I talk? Let's go to verse 20. Paul says, and when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I was also standing by and consenting unto his death, and kept the raiment of them that slew him. So, if you were gonna be one of the ones throwing the stones, you need to take off your outer garment. Paul was there. He was gonna throw any stones, but he's gonna hold the garments. He was responsible. He was partly responsible, and he admits that. Paul was zealous when he was younger, but his zeal was obviously misguided, just as James and John's zeal was misguided when they were ready to call fire down from heaven. Or all the disciples' zeal was misguided when they said, you know, we're ready, we'll suffer with you. You don't have anything to worry about. We're tight. We're, you know, a band of 12. We're going to hang in here. It says all the disciples said that. See, with Jesus, was Judas? I don't guess he was still there. So, anyway, we all have our zealous experiences, I assume. I know I have mine that embarrass me today. And all this works together for my point number 5. And that is, point 5, working with people takes time. Zeal does not equal maturity. There's a difference between zeal and maturity. Working with people takes time. Zeal does not equal maturity. It's easy to be zealous, perhaps, when we're young and got a lot of energy. But maturity, you can't buy it. You can't read a book and all of a sudden become mature. It takes time, doesn't it? Some of you are more mature than others in terms of we've been around longer than others. And those of you that are your oldest, you understand that the best. And those of us that are younger, I'm not younger anymore, but I'm younger than some of you, we don't understand it as much. And I know that 40 years ago, I didn't understand much of anything. But I thought I did. That's just the way it is with life. So God has chosen this path of getting things done, and it involves using people. And these people that he uses are sometimes more zealous than they are mature. That's why things get messy. That's one of the reasons why things get messy. So I have one more point. And this was the only one I'm going to tell you ahead of time. But I'm going to ask your input, maybe. Or I'll ask it. We'll see if we get any. Why does God do it this way? Why does God do it this way? That's the point. I've got some answers. Maybe you've got some. I've got 5. Why would God choose a system of working that doesn't work very well? It doesn't work as well as turning a light switch on and off. That involves delegating things to imperfect human beings that are going to mess it up. That also just sometimes it's totally messy. Even the greatest heroes show that they sometimes don't get it right. And sometimes when delegating these jobs to people, their zeal to get it done actually makes things worse than they were before they did anything, because they don't have the maturity to go with it yet. And I'm saying they, but I'm talking about myself. I've been in that, been in those shoes too many times to remember. Why does God do it that way? All right, we got some answers. Good.
Because people are not perfect. So it's to teach us and help us to learn along the way.
All right, we have to learn along the way. Okay. That's good. Yeah, we're not perfect, so we have to make progress. Let's see if that fits into one.
We have to learn to protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Any, Dan?
Yeah, the story or the storyline or the being told also allows the example.
Examples for us. Yeah, we look in the Bible and we get all these imperfect people, and it is there for our edification. I would say encouragement even. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. Anybody else? And if you think of something as we're going along, feel free to add. Some of the answer, I think, or some answers are given in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And I want to go there first. That, to me, is the obvious place to start. We sing this song, or we used to. Excuse me. 1 Corinthians 1, I'm going to read some verses starting in verse 17. Where Paul's saying, you know, Christ didn't send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel. not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. So he's going to start talking about wisdom here. He says, for the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. What does he mean by that? I mean, you know, if you were in his time, he's going to talk to the Romans, you know, a Roman citizen, say, you know, you really want to be saved? This guy over here, he's the Savior. And a Roman would say, that guy we killed because he was an insurrectionist or, you know, a rebel? Say, you got a Savior? He's dead? Well, no, he's been resurrected. And yeah, sure, you know, we heard that one before. You know, you're not going to get anywhere. To a Roman citizen, that would be foolishness. To a Gentile, that's foolishness. And that's what he's talking about. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Okay, so God has already said ahead of time, this is going to be counterintuitive. You know, it's not going to be what you think. It's kind of the reverse of what you think it would be. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath God not made foolish the wisdom of the world? So the church in Corinth, for instance, wasn't full of a bunch of, you know, the top citizens of Corinth, the big time debaters, the big philosophers. They weren't in the church. And the church was full of a lot of other kind of people that didn't have much going for them, it seemed that sometimes. For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. So, I mean, Paul's being sarcastic here. He's talking foolishness preaching. He's saying this is the way that the Romans would, or, you know, a typical Roman citizen, a typical Gentile would look at it. For verse 22, for the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, which is unto the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. So the Jews aren't going to buy it either. You know, what kind of a Messiah is this? Messiah is supposed to save us from the Gentiles, not be killed from the Gentiles. And the Gentiles would say, we killed your Savior. Why am I supposed to follow the one that we killed? Because to them, that was obvious evidence that they or their gods were more powerful than your gods if our gods killed your gods. It was simple. They didn't have any problem with being multiple gods. We could all get along, be one big happy family, all these different gods, that's fine. But if your God died, that shows that our God's more powerful. That just made sense. So that's, to them, preaching the cross would be foolishness. Verse 24, but to them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, because of the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is far stronger than men. And then he talks about how our calling, not many wise or mighty or noble are called, but God has chosen the foolish of the world to confound the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the mighty, and the base things of the world, those things which are despised, I'm sorry, and things which are despised, God has chosen. And things that are not to bring to naught things that are. In other words, God's turning the tables. I've talked about that before, and that's what God does. We, the world, you know, the Gentile world at the time, they thought they had the answers. The Jewish world, they thought they had the answers. God comes in with something that neither one of them would accept, and it turned their worlds upside down. That's what he does. Just when you think you've got it figured out, God says, no, it's the opposite of what you think. And that's what Paul's talking about here. Why? Verse 29, that no flesh should glory in his presence. Him the glory, verse 31 says, let him glory in the Lord. Okay, so let's briefly just go through five. I got five of them. Why would God do this? And I will including what you all said. I think from here in 1 Corinthians, we have several. First of all, to distinguish between the wisdom of the world and the wisdom of God. All right? You can write down as a reference James chapter 3 and verse 17 and 18 when it talks about the godly wisdom. Godly wisdom is not the same as worldly wisdom. And when God does things the way he does it and he accomplishes things in spite of the fact that he's using imperfect human beings, it shows the difference and the distinction between the wisdom of the world and the wisdom of God. So that, to me, is one point that's brought out here in 1 Corinthians 1. Another one, and it talks about this foolishness of preaching. But it's said that God has decided to do this through preaching. Now, if I can explain a little bit before I give you the point. God could have decided he was going to build a church through all kinds of different mechanisms, right? He's God, he can do what he wants. The one he picked involved preaching. That's what Paul says. What is preaching? Preaching is you talk, somebody else listens. I talk, somebody else listens. It's relational, right? It involves communication. Paul wrote to Timothy, you know, I'm persuaded that you have this a certain spirituality in your bones, as it were, because of your grandmother and your mother. You know, you've been around this. It's part of you. In the beginning of the book of Acts, there's only 120 people there in that upper, you know, in this area, wherever they're gathered. Now, there were 12 disciples, 12 became 12 apostles. That's only 10. And you have his brothers, Jesus' brothers, and his mother. So there aren't many more people there than just his disciples and their families. I mean, there might have been a few, but there weren't many. See, you think he'd been preaching for 3 years, and these are all the people that followed. But the point is that all of his miracles, all of this, and this is, you know, wasn't the time for the release of the Holy Spirit. The church grew by leaps and bounds after this. But all of his preaching, the people that came to be followers were, for the most part, people that he had personal, close relationships with. And what have they found in the history of, I'm sure, of many churches, not just the churches that we've been a part of, and that is, regardless of what the church tries to do as a public outreach and all of that, which is all good and nothing against any of that, but even with all of that, the number one reason why people come to church is because of a relationship they have with somebody else who's already coming to church. Because people are relational. That's the way we're made. And that's my second point. God made us the second point under why does God do it this way? Because God made us relational. That's the way he created us. So saving people is accomplished in a relational way. That's just the way God has made us. It's his design. A third point here, and it's obvious in 1 Corinthians 1:29, and that is, God does it this way so no flesh can glory. If God called the rich, the famous, the smart, the talented, and they did wonderful things, we'd say, well, of course they did talented things. These are the rich and smart and you know, all that. But he calls average people, normal people, and he accomplishes his will. And then we have to say, well, it's not us. It's the Spirit of God. It's God doing it. And that's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians. In James, you could write down James chapter 2, verses 1 to 9, where James is talking about poor people and not liking, you know, there was prejudice against poor people in the church. He's saying, you're poor compared to most people. You know, you should understand that God calls the poor. That's what he does. Now, Sandy mentioned, you know, we learn ourselves from all of this. And that's certainly part of this, that we're in a process. We're not where we need to be. We're just in a process of getting there. And so this whole way that God does things should be, and I think is, a source of encouragement for us. That God would use us in spite of our problems. And that God would teach us while we have our problems and teach us to overcome those problems and to be better as a result. And that he gets it done in spite of us. When somebody believes in you, even though you slip and fall, that's an encouraging thing, isn't it? And God really does have your back. Not like the disciples who abandoned Jesus, but God is really there for you. So this way of accomplishing things is it teaches us, and it's encouragement. It's encouragement for the normal people. And it's certainly encouraging because we get to look at the examples in the past, as Dan said, of normal people with normal problems that God used in spite of their normality. You know, it shows that God can use us too. And I have one more. And it's not from 1 Corinthians here, but you can write down Luke chapter 5 and verse 30. 30 to 32. And that is that it's all about saving sinners. That's what it's all about. God is in the business of saving sinners. That's what the whole book's about. So among those sinners are some that he can use and be an encouragement to the rest. But, you know, Jesus said, you know, they were complaining about the kind of people he was hanging out with. He said, well, it's the people that are sick that need the doctor. You know, that I came, he said, to save sinners. Not to, you know, he could have said, no, I didn't come here to hobnob with the people who already think they're good. They already think they're saved. He didn't say it that, but that's what he's implying. I came to save sinners. The whole Bible's like that. The whole Bible, especially I think the New Testament, but even Old Testament, where, you know, God chose the younger instead of the older, and different things that he did. God chooses who he wants. But it's all in an encouraging way, you know. God turns the tables. Jesus said, the first shall be last, the last shall be first. Jesus said, if you're going to seek to save your life, you're going to lose it. If you seek to lose your life, you'll save it. He's always showing these opposites from the way things are presumed to be, showing that God doesn't think that way and God doesn't work that way. It's more blessed to give than to receive. Oh, it's kind of backwards. How can you be blessed? That is, blessing is something you get. And you get blessed by giving. Well, it's backwards. But that's the way God works. God turns the tables. I like to point out at this time of year, for the sake of thinking about Christmas, at the birth of Jesus, who were the witnesses to his birth? Who were the first witnesses? Everybody remember?
Mary and Joseph.
You're exactly right. That's not what I was thinking, but that is the right answer. They were there, and whatever other family. I'm sorry, what I meant was outside witnesses, outside the family.
The ones that came with the
ones that came, what?
The kings.
Oh, they were later.
The other ones.
Yeah, who were the other ones?
The shepherds.
Shepherds were the first ones, yeah. But the kings came later, or the astronomers, whatever they were, the ones from the east. He was already probably pretty old by then, or, you know, a year or two. But the shepherds came. What's interesting about that? Who cares whether they were shepherds? Remember, I've mentioned this to you before. This is for Ray and Sandy and Rick. Shepherds were presumed to be dishonest. Now, why? They were presumed to be dishonest because they could, you know, they could sell something. We're not talking about people who owned a sheep like you do. But if you hired somebody to watch your sheep, you know, whether you trust them or not, well, it was presumed that they were going to be dishonest because they would sell something. They would sell one of the sheep and then tell the owner of the sheep, well, this lion came, you know, I certainly couldn't fight the lion. You know, so they could always make an excuse. And it was just, that's just the way it was in that culture. They assumed that the shepherds were lying. And because of that, the testimony of shepherds was not allowed in court because they were assumed to be dishonest. And who else was not allowed to, there were probably many, but who else of a major portion of society was not allowed to testify in court?
Tax collectors.
I don't know about that. Maybe. Who?
Women.
Women were not allowed to testify in court. And who were the first witnesses of Jesus' resurrection?
Women.
That to me just proves the way God is. God says, you know, you got your rules about that. I'm going to turn it upside down. You don't want to believe the testimony of the shepherds. They're going to be the first people outside the family. Thank you, Leah. The first people outside the family that are going to see Jesus when he's born. And you don't allow the testimony of women. They're going to be the first ones to see that he was resurrected. That's just the way God does things. And I think it's kind of neat. So anyway, I've been all through all these points. I've already summarized, so I won't do it again. Our God is a relational God. That's the way he made us. He wants to relate with us. He wants us to relate with him. He wants to have a relationship. In ages past, he's chosen to accomplish his will by working through people. People that were imperfect. People that had all kinds of issues and problems. Even the heroes have feet of clay. You know, they have flaws or something that might be that holds them down. In Jesus' case, it was just being human that held him down a bit. That's by design. But God does accomplish what he wants to do in spite of all that. And that's encouraging to us. Those examples are encouraging to us. And the fact that God can accomplish through us while we're learning and while we're increasing in our wisdom, as Sandy pointed out. So we're not the latest and we won't be the last that God will use to accomplish his will. But we are not so talented and smart and rich that God needs us. On the contrary, the miracle is that God accomplishes what he wants to do in using average people like you and like me. So to God be the glory. It's he gets it done.